Welcome to September from the New Talk, the Bob Davis Podcasts. In this podcast, podcast 546, we're going to talk about what's next, because as I speak, the big solar eclipse for the month of September 2016 is underway. I'll tell you what's next. What's next is the climate change event that we call winter in the upper Midwest. Now, we're a ways out. The state fair is still on. The weather is fine, but we're going to start that slide towards colder and colder weather, and you're going to turn your furnace on, and how efficient is it, okay? Does it work? Do you need new filters? Now, a lot of people do that stuff on their own, but you really should have Ryan Plumbing and Heating come over and check the heating system to make sure everything is running properly and that you don't have any funky problems, because you never know, and you want it to work when you turn it on when it gets cold. Call Ryan Plumbing and Heating in St. Paul to get them to come out and check your heating. 651-224-4771 in Minneapolis, 612-927-6488. They go metro-wide from St. Paul. That means the suburbs, too. When they come out to check the heat, you can ask them about high-efficiency heat. If you haven't converted and you can do it now, you will save the cost of the installation over the next 4 or 5 years in terms of heating bills. For 4 generations, quality replacement and repair of all plumbing, heating, and air conditioning systems, residential and business, Ryan Plumbing and Heating on University Avenue in St. Paul, just west of the state capitol where they've always been. They can get a plumber to you whether you are in the suburbs or Minneapolis or St. Paul, so it doesn't matter whether you're way out in, you know, Plymouth or someplace like that, or on the other side of the metro in West St. Paul or someplace like that. Ryan Plumbing and Heating in St. Paul, 651-224-4771 in Minneapolis, 612-927-6488, metro-wide at ryanplumbing.com. Don't forget Ryan Plumbing and Heating for emergency service as well. They do great residential and business emergency service. Ryan Plumbing and Heating, one more time, in St. Paul, 651-224-4771 in Minneapolis, 612-927-6488, Ryan Plumbing and Heating. Well, it's a perfect night on the deck at the broadcast bunker. I just had a fabulous dinner, chicken breasts with rosemary and thyme, bacon, butter, and lemon and white wine, sauteed in Crisco oil, and it was fabulous. There's something about, I don't know what it is about Crisco oil. It's obviously a substance of the devil, because it makes everything taste so good, and I don't know how that works, but I should get Crisco oil as a sponsor. You know? So I just had a great dinner. I feel great. Coffee and then broccoli and everything. And I actually bought some corn chips tonight, so I'm just struggling with corn chips because I can't eat corn chips, of course, while I'm doing a podcast. So I might have to stop and have a couple of corn chips, but I got some delicious coffee here. It is Verona and Italian roast. I wasn't able to find any Komodo Dragon coffee. I got to stop talking about it because Komodo Dragon is sold out at all the Starbucks I go to. So, as we speak, as I said, the great solar eclipse of September 1st, 2016 is underway. It starts in Eastern Africa and it works its way east. We will not see it in the United States, but it started and it will be underway during the time that I am podcasting tonight, sitting out here on the deck. Because, as you know, I do these things really, really late. And I've been pondering what to do for a podcast the last couple of days and the last hours before I made dinner and everything. And I usually wait till late at night to do this stuff. And it won't be too much longer that I will not be able to be out here on the deck. And you can hear, I mean, it's, you can hear the creatures, but there aren't as many. I don't know if you've noticed this. The creatures kind of fade after a while. And what you can actually hear, if you listen closely, I'm turning the microphone toward it, you can hear the road construction, which is actually going on, and I'm pleased to announce going on 24 hours a day, not too far from my house. And so you'll probably hear that more than you will hear the creatures, because there's actually a chill in the air, and they're kind of tamped down a little bit. But it may be the solar eclipse, too. Usually creatures, you know, I've noticed tonight, just as the sun went down, I noticed that the creatures kind of, usually the squirrels are running around out here raising hell and fighting, and the birds are caw-cawing and everything else, and it was really quiet tonight, so I thought that was interesting. The great solar eclipse of September 1st, 2016 underway. And as I thought about to do, you know, what I wanted to do for a podcast for this this podcast, you know, I've said this before, so I really don't want to belabor this, but the airwaves, cable TV, podcasting, even, is too full of political commentary. Whether it's comedy and serious talk or day-to-day news, I decided today it is not entertaining or interesting to add to the cacophony right now about what I think or whether or not I have insights or something to say. Well, I have things to say. There's no question about that. But I think I will save much of the political stuff for the next podcast that I do on the state-by-state polls, the electoral fight at the end of September. Doesn't mean there won't be political podcasts between now and the end of September. It means that much of what is going on day-to-day is just posturing. You know, it's interesting because I'm not trying to get people to think that I don't talk about or think about politics anymore, because I do. I'm just not interested in going day to day on things that are happening because it's everywhere. You know, 10 years ago, it wasn't so much everywhere. Now it's literally, we are drenched with mostly political opinioning and posturing going on. I go through the news every day, and I save links. In other words, I pull stories that I think are interesting, and I put them in a reader file. And I go through this file every now and then, which usually has hundreds of stories, and I weed it out. And I have to tell you that almost everything I pull and save loses its salience and impact after just a few days. Most of it, and I've warned you about this, is basically advocacy journalism in one form or another. I try to save the financial stories that aren't necessarily advocacy-oriented, although even in the financial press, there's a lot of this bear versus bull stuff where people write articles and then give proofs for why they think it's a bear market or a bull market. And I think what's going on in our media is, first of all, and I don't want to belabor this either because I've talked about this before, a lot of these sites are basically, they pull stories from another site and rewrite it. So if somebody actually does some reporting on a particular thing, a particular instance, then that reporting is rehashed and rehashed and rehashed. There's little new to report about that thing. And then what you get is the opinioning, and I'm going to call it opinioning, based on that thing, whatever it is. Not much new journalism, so to speak. So what you get is advocacy journalism in one form or another. Literally, we used to call it yellow journalism, which is what William Randolph Hearst excelled at back around the turn of the 20th century. This idea that the editor will ask for a story with a certain perspective. The famous William Randolph Hearst story is that Hearst sent a reporter and an artist down to Havana when the Maine blew up. We now know that the USS Maine blew up because of some sort of issue in the magazine. And the Hearst cabled his reporters down there, and they said, well, there's nothing to report. It was an accident. And he said, you supply the pictures, I will supply the war. And that's, you know, he exhorted people to the Spanish-American War, which took place largely because of newspapering. So that's what I'm talking about, yellow journalism in one form or another. And it's everywhere. An editor will ask for a story with a certain perspective. He'll get a story with a perspective and push it upon himself to present a point of view buttressed with his own facts, and I use the term lightly, to prove the premise of the story. This is going on with Russia today, which is little more than propaganda. It's going on with InfoWars. It's going on with almost every news source that you can find. That is, we do not have the assemblage of the pertinent facts in a particular occurrence and related said facts. What we have is advocacy journalism. And that is what we have throughout the country, whether it's in social media or on the evening news. Now, maybe we've had it and we have always had it and we just didn't know that we've always had it. Certainly the William Randolph Hearst story goes back more than 100 years. It doesn't mean there aren't interesting developments. It doesn't mean that people don't have interesting opinions. It doesn't mean that there aren't valid opinions based on facts and hearsay as well. It doesn't mean I'm not engaged in those questions. It's just that this is what everybody in the news and the politics genre is spending their time talking about right now. And I think for the most part, people's minds, at least pertaining to the election, are pretty much made up. Now, a lot of people think that that's ridiculous. You're crazy, you know, but I think most people have in their mind what they think they will probably do, and I don't think much in the political realm is going to change that. Certainly, you know, there's caveats to that, but, you know, and I'll discuss the caveats, and I'll discuss whether or not these kinds of, their minds are made up, conclusions are valid or not, as I go forward and do the state-by-state poll podcast, as opposed to the you know, the national presidential preference, which is nothing more than what's your favorite radio station this week kinds of a question on the national level. We have to look at the state-by-state polls to determine the contours of the election and whether or not people's minds are being changed by the campaigns. May some people on the fringe come around to a particular candidate? You know, I'd have to say that I don't think that they will. I think the fight now is about getting people out to vote and making sure that congressional candidates win in tight races, depending on what your party affiliation is. And again, depending on your party affiliation, mobilizing in states and on issues that matter in those states. All you have to do is just take a look at your Facebook or your Twitter feed, and it's going to tell you how solidified, how gelled the political opinion in this country is. Most of the campaign is being conducted via social media and national television, and you tell me if you think, based on what you see, if people are going to change their points of view based on a, you know, a meme about Hillary Clinton or something to that effect. Basically, I've moved beyond that process. In fact, I am very uninterested in that process, that day-to-day process of trying to convince and cajole and, you know, everything else. I don't think the outcome can be predicted at this point. I'm not trying to say that. I'm just not mentally engaged in what the candidates are saying and what they are doing and what it means. Because as I've said before, and I don't want to be repetitive, but I don't think either party is going to do what needs to be done in the coming 4 years. In fact, I think both will fail miserably because they just, there are things that we need to do now, and we're just setting ourselves back if we don't do them, and I don't think we're going to do them because I don't think the so-called electorate, we the people, are where we need to be to get these things done. And I think it's going to take a new crisis, a turning point. I think there will be a new crisis or turning point, a national challenge, whatever you want to call it. I don't know what that is going to be. I can't predict the future. But I think what has to happen is there needs to be a national challenge to clarify the direction that we need to go so that our leaders can actually lead. And make no mistakes, people want to be led. I've come to the conclusion that they want someone else to do the talking. They want someone else to do the work, and they want someone else to figure out the complexities of the issues at hand. They don't want to be bothered with it, and they'll follow, and I'm talking about all of us. We'll follow someone along until the next one comes along, or until that person, politician, whatever, fails or doesn't do what people who followed him think that he was supposed to do or what he, quote, said he was going to do, unquote, and they will unfollow and wait for the next leader. There's no real work being done by the people that support these people who they are expecting to, quote unquote, lead them. And this, of course, is how we got into the mess that we're in. But I guess we're always in some kind of mess, so that's not really a huge point. For me, it is about watching how it's all going to play out now. And I am not here to convince you, as I have said, and I will continue to say, because I think it's really, really important that people understand, I am not here to cajole, to admonish, to plead and demand, to tell you what's right, because I'm not sure that I know what's right on any of these issues. I'm not confused or waffling. I have simply seen too many of these situations where advocacy has resulted in an outcome that simply doesn't make sense. You think they're going to do one thing, and you support and push and fight for that, and then they don't do that. Or things just don't play out the way we were told or we thought or might be expected that they would have played out. So I guess what I'm trying to say to people is how you vote, why you vote, is your business and your problem, and I'm not going to let that come between us. you know, as being friends or listeners or subscribers or anything else. I just don't. I'm more interested in the outcome and watching what happens, almost as a, you know, an armchair sociologist, as opposed to telling people what they're supposed to do. So eclipses are supposed to be reboots. Solar and lunar movements have been part of religion and in some eras, government, since human beings became organized into social groups. You know, the great religion of Rome prior to Christianity was, of course, Mithraism, which is based on, you know, the movement of the planets, among other things. In the earliest clans and tribes, the smartest of the people, the smartest of the group, were selected to protect the information about the movements in the heavens. They became the high priests. That was their gig, to figure out when things were going to happen. And they were treated with great reverence. The Jewish calendar, even, is based on lunar movements. The so-called standard calendar is a Gregorian calendar, which is based on the movement of the earth around our sun. The Islamic calendar is a lunar calendar. Our calendar is named after Pope Gregory the 13th, who introduced it in 1582. So the calendar that we use isn't a lunar calendar. But I use the example of the Jewish and Islamic calendars being lunar calendars so that people understand that, you know, the moon and the stars are very important to us historically. They are almost, they were a very religious affair, even if you don't accept astrology. And of course, astrologers place great emphasis on these things. But paying attention to these kinds of things is a very deep human thing. It's almost an instinct that is probably hardwired into our DNA. Does our behavior change at eclipses and things? I don't know. It's hard to tell. But if it's in our DNA, and if for the purposes of this podcast, a solar eclipse is about a reboot, what is coming, you know, what's going to come after, why not use this as it is happening as a discussion to talk about what's next? Well, I had an interesting experience tonight, and it has to do with Hydrus, and I'm going to tell you about it in a second. Hydrus is this new high-performance beverage that I've been using for exercise, and I do yoga, of course. Hydrus uses exclusive nanosome technology to get critical electrolytes into your system with unrivaled speed and effectiveness without the sugar in traditional sports drinks. So it's really a plus if you don't want to put a lot of sugar into your system. So everybody knows I practice yoga. You do yoga in hot rooms with lots of people, and you sweat a lot, and hydration is really, really important. And I'll just tell you very quickly, because they've done studies, if you drink a quart of water before you go into a yoga class and it's 105 degrees in there, you're not going to be fully hydrated until about 40 minutes in, 30 to 40 minutes in. And of course, you're sweating, so you're dehydrating as the water is coming in, so you're not going to get hydrated rapidly. And this is why people should use Hydrus, because it hydrates you really fast. It gets electrolytes into your system really fast. And I'm going to tell you how fast it gets those electrolytes into your system very quickly. So tonight I did a sculpt, which is really a challenging class. This is yoga with weights. There's a lot of cardio. You're running around. And I do it because it makes me stronger for the other kind of yoga that I do. And it's usually filled with young people. And it's super loud music. And everybody's jumping up and down and doing all this crazy stuff. And it's, you know, if you're not ready for it, it can be really challenging. Well, tonight's class was pretty hard. You know, a lot of squats and things like that aren't great for my knees, but I do it, and I did it, and I got through it, and everything's fine. But when I got home, I kind of swooned, and I was like, wow, you know, so what did I do? Well, I had another Hydrus, which is, you know, mix this into 16.2 or 3 ounces of water, and, you know, I usually take a couple of those with me, and I had one before class, and I had one during class, so I hadn't drank the one yet from after class. And I thought, well, I'm just going to drink this. So I drank it, and I got to tell you, it was like 10 seconds, and I rebooted that fast, and I was ready to go, ready to do my podcast, ready to go to the store, and everything else. So let me tell you more about Hydrus. If you want to find out more, if you want to order it, it's real simple. You go to HydrusPerformance.com. That's H-Y-D-R-U-S, HydrusPerformance.com. A lot of content on there about people that are using it. Everything you want to know right there at HydrusPerformance.com. Get some. You'll be amazed at what it does. HydrusPerformance.com. When I say what's next, I don't mean in November of 2016 or January of 2017. I mean well after that moment. I mean what's next in your life. What's next in my life. How often do you ask yourself that question? What's next in my life? One time when I was in music radio, I got fired, and I did a podcast about this whole thing about internalizing or attaching oneself to what they do as a personal identity. And I had internalized getting fired, and I was actually really upset. And this very wise friend said to me, "You know, it doesn't matter what is in the past. The only thing that people care about is what's next." And she was talking about our business, but she was saying, these people don't care what you did. They only care about what you're going to do next. And I've never forgotten that. What's next also asks this question, who's in charge? Am I in charge of my own life? How often do I remind myself that I'm in charge of my own life? And I don't mean this in a spiritual sense, because I know there's people out there that are saying, well, God's in charge of your life, or you have to turn things over. You can't just say, you know, I'm in charge of my own life. But I don't mean it that way. I mean that as an adult, I don't mean divine guidance, which I definitely factor in. Divine guidance is an important part of my life. But in a real sense, what I'm talking about is adults making decisions about their lives. You know, we make decisions that affect our lives. We take responsibility for those decisions, I guess. I guess we're supposed to, right? And of course, sometimes we make bad decisions. You know, I shouldn't have said that. I shouldn't have done that. I shouldn't have taken that job. That was a mistake. How often do you hear that? Well, that was a mistake. I shouldn't have bought that Jeep. That was a mistake. I shouldn't have bought, you know, this thing is not working. That was a mistake to buy that. Or conversely, boy, it was great. I'm so glad I made the decision to go to the state fair. Or that was a good move. I made that move and that was really good. I'm glad that I took that job. I'm glad I did that. I'm glad I closed the windows on the camper because it's going to rain. Right? And I think as a people, we should be asking the same question. Who's in charge of our life? How much autonomy do I have in this society? How much autonomy do we have in this society? And how can I get more? Is more autonomy good? I think it's good, personally. How can I get more autonomy? Do I want more autonomy? Some people don't want more autonomy. Some people don't want the responsibility of actually being free. They would prefer to have other people make the decision. They don't want to be free. So when you walk around saying things like, we have too many, there's too much government in our lives, or we're not free to make decisions, some people are like, well, I'm okay with that because I don't want to have to think about that stuff. I want to have somebody take care of me from cradle to grave. That's okay as far as I'm concerned. And I want to take care of other people for that reason. And in terms of life in general and what I'm doing, I have decided to start reading again. And for a long time, you know, I spent so much time looking at the news of the day that I just wasn't reading. And I've decided I'm going to start reading again. And I've been reading sort of a little bit, but now I'm really stepping it up. I just finished the CIA World Factbook, which I highly recommend. Just as a, you know, you don't even have to be a good reader to read the World Factbook, because it's just a series of facts about countries. You know, how many people are in them, and the geography, and where they are, and whether they're landlocked, and things like that. So I love that. And so now I'm going through the library, my little library in my son's room, which he never stays in because he doesn't live here. I have a library. I put all my books in there. And I have discovered that there are a lot of books from my talk radio days that I saved. They were free books that were sent to me by people, publishers or whatever, in addition to my favorite books that I've saved. There's a bunch of books I haven't read, so I'm pulling them out one at a time and randomly, and I'm starting to read them. So I picked one out about the antebellum South, the South before the Civil War, and then the 3 months between the first shots being fired at Fort Sumter, when there might have been a chance to avoid the Civil War, and the Battle of the First Bull Run, when the war commenced in earnest. And I'll tell you a quick story, which is not in this book. At least I don't know if it is or it isn't. But so Bull Run is out Route 236 in Northern Virginia. So today that is a four-lane highway, basically. And you come right off 495 in Annandale, Virginia, and you can follow 236 all the way out through Fairfax and the Fairfax Courthouse, all the way out to Manassas, which isn't too far out. It's still obviously in the Washington Metro. It's only a few miles from Fairfax, Virginia, which is the county seat for Fairfax County, right? And back in the day, the whenever it was summer of 1861, I guess, maybe, yeah, I guess it was in the summer of 61, this was the first big battle of the Civil War. So everybody knew it was going to take place, and the Confederate troops marched there, and the Union troops marched down Route 236 on their way to Bull Run. To protect the, ostensibly to protect the Capitol, I guess. The idea was that they were going to defeat the Union at Bull Run, and they would march forward across the, I would assume it would have been the Chain Bridge in Georgetown at the time, into Washington, D.C., and take over. It was a coup, basically. That was the idea. And that, I'm sure that there are Civil War buffs out there that will say, well, that wasn't the idea, but okay. Roughly, the idea was to defeat the Union Army in the field, and win the war in one battle. And everybody thought that the Union Army was going to win, and everybody thought the South thought the Northern Army of Northern Virginia was going to win. And people lined that highway with people went out there in wagons. Families took lunches and went out there to watch this battle. And, of course, they were horrified when the battle commenced and the things that people did not know proved that, the casualties were horrific and that no side could actually fight to a victory. It was a standoff, and it was horrific. And if you've ever toured the battlefield there, you will be struck, especially if you've read a lot of World War II history, if you just have sort of a cursory understanding of military science, the very first thing that will impress you is these people were fighting at distances of 45 and 50 feet. This is not a big battlefield. So they talk a lot about the Henry House and the Battle of Bull Run and the Stone Bridge and the Stone House, which served as a hospital in that battle. And if you stand next to the Henry House, you can look, well, if you stand at one point where they engaged, you can see the Henry House, and then directly within your vision is the Stone Arch, the Stone Bridge, and then the Stone House that served as a hospital. So we're talking about very close distances. And of course, the story is that people ran willy-nilly from the battle because the cannon were much more powerful than people expected. It also shows how those people really didn't understand war. You know, it's just coming back down to us now through history how bloody the Revolutionary War was. So these people really didn't, they didn't really know war. They didn't really understand what was going to happen out there. So this is one of the things that you get. The things that people thought, the projections that people made at the time about what was going to happen were in fact wildly wrong. And as I'm reading this book, it's obvious, and I've read this in other places, so this isn't anything unusual, but people seemed at the time to be possessed by some sort of animal spirit, so to speak, almost like they were, possessed by something else. And I thought about it, the people at that time were younger. Older people were not as numerous as they are now. Most of the people were in their teens, 20s, 30s, and 40s. If you were 60, you were old. The chiefs, in Washington and in Montgomery were older, but for the most part, these people were young, and so they were self-possessed. They were elemental in that they acted without asking or being interested in the consequences, and they acted from their worldview, which was very small. They lived in the town that they grew up in, and they died in the town that they grew up in, and they didn't move too much, and they dealt with their family and their family relationships. They had big families, and they didn't think too much about the consequences of things. And I think that the Civil War, for that reason, in the United States, is an amazing story. And I often have wondered whether those people had any idea of what was to come. And I think the answer has been fairly well answered by historians, that the answer is no, they did not. Very few of them really understood what was going to happen when the North and South went at it. And it goes for the North as well as the South. People in both parts of the country did not understand the forces that they had unleashed. What animated those people? What kinds of ideas made them and pushed them in these directions? And these, of course, are questions that historians have been answering or trying to answer for many, many, many years. And, of course, I am so obsessed with this idea of trying to figure out where we stand in history, what we are on the edge of that we cannot see. Now, there are things that we don't know. Now, we can answer some of those things by finding the information on those things. We just have to find the information to answer the questions that we have. And there are things we do not know because they are unknowable. Couple of examples. you know, there's theories that fusion energy is possible, but nobody's been able to come up with it. And we cannot, we know that fusion energy is at least theorized, but we cannot know when it will become a reality and usable in our infrastructure. And when it does, if it does, it will revolutionize everything because it's an unlimited source of electricity, basically. We theorize that travel to other planetary systems is possible through wormholes, but we don't know yet how to do that. We don't even know if it's possible, but if it becomes possible, it will completely change our perception of the universe, not just the world. These days, a lot of time and effort is being devoted to nonsense, you know, all over the place, whether it's social media, you know, current books, you know, regular old media, time being devoted to questions that aren't even worth answering or questions that can never be answered. What would have happened if Hitler had won World War II? That kind of thing. And this is what you see most of the time on History Channel, which we used to call the Hitler Channel, by the way. But nonsense is what we're caught up with almost constantly on all of the media that we see. And it becomes topics of conversation. What if we devoted just a tiny part of our time and effort to answering knowable questions? Things that we can find out about. How might things be different? Isn't that what media is supposed to do? To inform and enlighten? To tell us the facts? So what if we devoted a tiny part of our time to actually finding out about things that we could know about? For example, I had dinner with some friends this week, and we talked about the Middle East. And it's amazing and shocking when you talk about the great group of people, you know, how many of us are really deeply uninformed about the Middle East. And I would include myself in that to a large degree. But these are things that are knowable. We can find out facts about the Middle East. We can find out facts about basic economics, you know, empirical facts that can inform us about, you know, economic policy and opinions about economic policy. We don't study these things. We don't know where to go for the information. We don't even know what questions to ask when we're trying to Google things. But the facts are there and we can know them. So if we started with the things that we don't know but could with some study, we might get a better look at the things that we don't know and understand a little bit more about what we don't know. I've often talked about the building blocks of a new society. Each era in history has been built on the shoulders of the previous era. The era. The Industrial Revolution built on the shoulders of the better farming methods. People ate better. They were, you know, they were smarter because they ate better. They had higher skills because they worked on the farm. Then they went to work in factories. They became even more highly skilled. Better factories, bigger factories, more stuff. And then, you know, 60, 70, 80, 100 years later, the technology revolution was built on the ashes of the Industrial Revolution because we needed new tools and so on. A good example is when Howard Hughes was doing all of his stuff with aircraft, trying to beat do speed records and flying around the world and everything else. People thought he was just doing it because he was an egotist, which he was. But what he was actually doing was looking for the smooth air so that when he actually started TWA, he knew where the air routes were. He was able to take that information that he had gleaned from his trips and carry that out to creating TWA. You know, it's been easier for me than some to make money in podcasting because I have had 40 years of experience in radio and management and sales and things like that. So I've been able to employ that skill and that knowledge that I learned working in radio. So that's a good example. And I'm sure other people, you all have experiences that you can understand. This is what I'm talking about. And what are we talking about? We're talking about conspiracy theory. We are shouting at each other about the personalities of people we do not know and we will never know them. I will never know Barack Obama, okay? And I don't see any point in shouting at people about Barack Obama's personality or Hillary Clinton's personality because I'm never going to know. Hillary Clinton is never going to come to my house and hang out on the deck. And in the process, we're missing the chance to take the time to learn more about the world, our world, and building the new world because we are building the new world whether we want to or not. The information that we need to do and to build this more this new world with some level of responsibility if we're adults isn't going to come from the media. It's not going to come from social media. It isn't going to come from cable TV news. It's not going to come from the generally accepted channels. As I said, look at your Facebook or Twitter feed and ask me if that's something that you would really want to spend time with, reading and understanding to understand people. Someday it will be looked at as an effort to try to understand what animated people, but I think it's BS. Most of it's just crap. It doesn't mean anything. The news and the information is going to come from libraries. It's going to come from taking the time to read and to amass facts, to discern which facts are important and to assemble them to tell some kind of a story to you, not to other people. It's a story you are telling yourself. So you're doing it. If you take an approach to learn like an investigator or an intelligence officer might learn about an issue, just because you want to know about it. We are facing complicated times, complicated issues on foreign policy, military policy, tax policy, government agencies, city government, the markets and business and banking, and things are very complicated. The tools we use are complicated. Answering the question of what's next when it comes to a nation isn't like saying, what am I going to do tomorrow? Or is it? If something like a solar eclipse is a reboot, if you will, a door opening into the future, a rush of new blood and new energy, why don't we take the opportunity to start asking, what's next? Where do we go from here? How do we get there? How do we build it? How do we know the thing that we want to do is going to work? How will it work when we build it? What might the problems be with it? Somebody much smarter than me recently asked this question. We were having lunch, and this friend of mine said, why do I do what I do? And I was like, wow, that's a pretty amazing question. Why do we do what we do? Why do we do what we do? I mean, I know why I'm doing the podcasting business, which I'm not going to share with people. I know what I want from the podcasting business. I know what I want from life. I know what I want to do. I can tell you that. I know that I want to have meaningful experiences. I'm actually more interested in having meaningful experiences these days than just about anything else. What do I want to see happen in my life and the world? That's another question. Those are deeper. And then, so my thinking in terms of this podcast is, well, the next question is, well, how do I answer those questions? And for me, it's about making a concerted effort to do the podcast about a topic that is more difficult to talk about. Talking about these things like how do you define yourself and what's next and, you know, the new thinking podcast, they are not easy because I have to put myself out and I have to say, you know, think about this. And they're not the stuff that people are talking about. And it's dangerous for us to do this as podcasters because sometimes people say, you know what, screw you, I'm done. So I risk that and I risk it. I risk it with great humor and happiness because I would rather do that than sit here and imitate Sean Hannity. And of course, I think it's refusing to be back, to be part of this back and forth based on news reports and nonsense, you know, and literally propaganda for the most part. And it's also for me pushing out to go to real places and talk to real people and see what is actually going on in some of these places where the, quote, news is. Like the primary race coverage where, you know, part of what has happened in my political, I'm not sure what to call it, but part of what has happened with me in politics was when I went out and covered the primary races. I learned a lot doing that. I learned an awful lot about how these things are done and what they mean and what and how the wool is being pulled over our eyes in a lot of places. And all I did was just go to the primary events and cover them as a human being, as a citizen. And I think it's about taking a more balanced view of people. People I don't agree with. And people I agree with, and suspending judgments about people, whether I agree or disagree with them, until I learn more about an issue or them. And also suspending my mouth until I actually learn more about those people and who they are, even those people that I agree with and disagree with. And I think suspending the mouth is the hardest part. It seems like a good place to start to answer this question, what's next? Don't forget HydrusPerformance.com. That is the website with all the information about Hydrus, where you order it, how you get it. It will transform whatever physical practice you do, even walking. And my mom is using it, so I'll give you reports from the general manager of the Bob Davis podcast about Hydrus Performance. And she's 94 years old, so we'll find out how it works. Don't forget HydrusPerformance.com. That's H-Y-D-R-U-S. Visit HydrusPerformance.com and find out more about getting hydrated in whatever practice you follow. HydrusPerformance.com. And, of course, winter is coming. We hear it all the time on the TV show. In fact, now they're saying winter is here on this season of Game of Thrones. So winter will be here soon enough. Don't forget to have Ryan Plumbing and Heating come out and check your heating. 651-224-4771 in St. Paul, in Minneapolis, 612-927-6488. They can get a plumber to you metro-wide. They are the experts when it comes to quality replacement and repair of all plumbing, heating, and air conditioning systems, residential and business. Ryan Plumbing. Also, check out their website at ryanplumbing.com. Oh, helicopters. I love the sound of helicopters in the middle of the night. It always makes me think there's obviously some dark force at work. Thanks to the digital sponsor of the Bob Davis podcast, Alpha Systems. If you're a pilot, you want to be safe on takeoffs and landings. We wish the pilots good luck. Alpha Systems makes the revolutionary angle of attack indicator. What is it? It's a visual indicator of your angle of attack or the lift under your airplane, and it's critical in general aviation when you make the final turn to land, right? And, you know, people crash all the time because they lose lift and they don't know. Well, Alpha Systems visual indicator is the best in the business. You can watch it to make sure that you're right in the zone to make sure that you have enough lift so that you can make that final turn with confidence and safety. The bottom line is Alpha Systems AOA saves lives. Click on the Alpha Systems banners at the top of the BobDavisPodcast.com and find more information about Alpha's revolutionary angle of attack indicator at the BobDavisPodcast.com. And yeah, pilots, good luck. Thanks for listening to the Bob Davis Podcast on Stitcher.com, iTunes, TuneIn, BlogTalkRadio.com. Thanks for listening to the Bob Davis Podcast radio show on The Patriot in Minneapolis at 11 p.m. on Sunday nights. If you want to hear it and you want to hear it when you want to hear it, you can also find it at the BobDavisPodcasts.com. And thanks for liking and sharing and favoriting and following on Facebook and Twitter. I'm on Instagram. And thanks for your donations as well for mobile podcast command at the BobDavisPodcast.com. What's next is some corn chips and coffee and movies till dawn here at the Broadcast Bunker. Thanks for listening to podcast 546, the Bob Davis Podcast. What's next?